balance. I heard an interesting business principle a few years ago. It said, if you ever want professionals to turn up for a business meeting, like a business networking breakfast, then tell them the discussion topic is engaging Gen Y in the workplace. Nothing will get managers coming along to a networking breakfast more than pointers on why Gen Y are so different and how to engage Gen Y in the workplace. Now, when I say Gen Y, I mean the group of people who were born between the early 80s and the late 90s. Now, while the exact bookends of Gen Y will differ from authority to authority, I think the most common dates are anyone born between 1981 and 1996. And so Gen Y, also known as millennials, are people who are currently in their early 30s to early 20s to late 30s. That's the sort of the group that we're talking about when we talk about Gen Y. And the reason business people turn up to anything that has engaging Gen Y in the title is because Gen Y, not only, well, firstly, they make up about a third of our workforce these days and growing. It's going to be more and more as the years go by. But secondly, Gen Y seems to have developed a bit of a reputation for being entitled, self-interested, lazy, and hard to get engaged. That's the reputation that a lot of people have about Gen Y. Now, personally, I find this reputation a little unfair. It's certainly not the case across the whole of the generation. All the Gen Y people I know are not what you would call like this. But here's the thing. Like all labels, they do come from somewhere. There's some element of truth to these labels. But what I want to show today, and I want to start by showing, it's actually not Gen Y's fault. Millennials are simply a product of their environment, like every generation is. So, for example, if you were looking at the silent generation, that's the generation, the title for the generation of people that were born between the First World War and the Second World War. And that generation has a reputation for being a little miserly, a little stingy with their money. But here's the thing, so would you be if you grew up in the Great Depression? Or then there's baby boomers. Baby boomers have a reputation for being a little anti-authoritarian. They don't like people in power. But here's the thing, so would we be if we grew up through the Nixon era, or, you know, the perpetual lies that came from politicians, particularly through the Vietnam War. So the reason millennials have a reputation for being entitled and for not coping well with hardship is that they're a product of their environment. So to begin with, millennials have enjoyed economic boom almost their entire lives. They haven't known want, except for that little blip in the GFC a couple of years back. Second, millennials can get pretty much anything they want immediately. You know, with the internet and with Amazon and with live streaming, you can get whatever TV show you want. Uber Eats will bring any food you want to your door these days. They're just used to getting anything they want. But on top of that, they've been raised by helicopter parents, or worse still, bulldozer parents. So helicopter parents are those parents that hang around, just want to make sure that their kids are safe and have everything they want. Bulldozer parents are those that go before their kids, knocking down any obstacle that might come along their way so that they have the easiest, cushiest life they can possibly get. And what this has resulted in, and it's through no fault of their own, really, is a generation that lacks resilience. They lack the ability to cope with hardship. But what we're finding is that this lack of resilience is seeping over into previous generations, like Gen Xers and baby boomers now. We're finding this lack of resilience across all ages. So when people of all ages go through suffering, we tend to cope, if I can use that in inverted commas, we tend to cope through things like, well, we need to sue someone for this suffering, or we need to demand that the government fix all this suffering, or we need to demand that the government will apologise for this suffering that I'm going through. It seems that all generations now think that when suffering comes our way, something catastrophic has gone wrong, and someone needs to be held accountable for that. Now, what I want to look at today is how all of us can build resilience So that when suffering comes in life, not if, but when it comes in life, we will have the tools at our disposal so that we won't get knocked down for the count. So even though our title for today is Understanding Gen Y and Resilience, that title was simply to spark people's interest, like a business breakfast. Well, I actually want us all to understand resilience better, to give us the tools so that we can handle life's hardships ourselves. And I've got three things that'll help us do this today, as your sermon outline suggests. So I want to begin by looking at why this problem has actually come about. Where did it come from? Why do people lack resilience? And then we're going to look at a two-step solution to build resilience. So I'll begin by looking at what to know about resilience, and then how to get resilience. All right, so that's our job for today. So let's figure out how we can better cope with hardship rather than being knocked down for the count, by looking at why people lack resilience, what to know about resilience, and how to get resilience. And we begin with a million-dollar question of why people in the West seem to find it hard to cope with hardship. Right? So why do so many people label Gen Y as entitled? As though they expect a life that is free of suffering. Why is it that when many Gen Xers and baby boomers don't get their way, they're all too quick to blame someone else for their problems? Well, look, friends, there's no simple answer to this. It's actually quite complicated. But because of time, we don't have enough time to go through all the complexities of why this situation has come to where it is. What I want to do is look at what I think are the top three reasons. Right, the top three reasons why we in the West struggle when it comes to hardship. And the first one is Western society itself. You see, you and I live in the worst society in history for preparing people to deal with suffering. The reason being that in ancient times, people knew suffering was inevitable in life. And the reason they knew that was because they believed that this life was not all there is. So people in ancient times, they said, look, even though I would like to have money and health and love and happiness in this life, if I don't get those things, there's always the next life. Yet Western culture today says, no, this life is all there is. And there's no afterlife, so we need to make sure we get our dessert in this life. And if we don't get money and health and love and happiness now, then we're going to miss out altogether. And here's the thing. Even those people who strongly believe in the afterlife, like us Christians, that's the culture we've been raised in and slowly cooked in for the last 20 or 30 years. And it affects us. And so even Christians today think, look, if I am suffering, then something has gone horribly wrong. This is not the way it should be. And what this has resulted in is an entire generation, or should I say generations, who have no idea how to cope with suffering because our society says we shouldn't need to. The second reason our lives are becoming gone a bit too far, I think. Oh, just two, is there? There you go. That's no good. The second reason our lives are becoming increasingly entitled is social media. We live in a time where people are becoming exposed at a very young age to this notion that everyone else out there is having a great life. Social media shows us post after post after post of the perfect couple enjoying the perfect smashed avocado at the perfect beachside cafe on their perfect holiday. And what we fail to realise, though, is not only how staged many of those look at my perfect life posts actually are, all right, it takes a lot of work to look like you're so relaxed, but we also ignore the fact that the rest of their day probably sat somewhere between the mundane to the stressed. But when many of us see everyone else having the perfect life, we feel that we deserve the perfect life too. And when we don't get it, it ruins us. Studies have actually shown that people who spend more time on Facebook have a higher likelihood of suffering depression than people who spend less time on Facebook. It's frightening, isn't it? Then, so we've got a society that expects happiness. We've got social media, the third major contributor. I'm just going to stick the rest of them up there. There you go. I don't know if there's more. Is there more? Oh, there you go. It's coming. They're out of order. I apologize for that, the screens. The third major contributor to this generation, their lack of resilience, is what people are calling a failed parenting strategy. One of Gen Y's biggest problems is they've been raised by parents who sheltered them from the real world. So there's a management guru by the name of Simon Sinek, and he says that the parents of Gen Y have ruined their kids because they told their kids that they're extra special. They've told their kids that they can have anything they want in the world. They complained to all their kids' teachers, so that their teachers got so sick of hearing from parents complain, they just gave their kids A's for everything. And they got medals for just participating. So if you come in last place these days, you get a medal. Now, the problem with that is that when these Gen Ys finally hit the workforce, they realise that, well, they're not actually special. They can't get whatever they want. Their mummy can't get them a promotion, and you get nothing for coming in last. And so what has happened is millennials, while they start their careers with a whole bunch of unearned self-esteem, that unearned self-esteem soon becomes crushed self-esteem. And when they get knocked down, they're down for the count. And it's because their helicopter parents or their bulldozer parents were more interested in keeping their kids happy and safe than actually training their kids for what the real world is like and making their kids strong. You see, when we swoop in and simply pick up the pieces for our teenagers every time something goes wrong, they never develop the skills to deal with hardship themselves. And so when hardship comes in their 20s and 30s, and it does come, their only way to cope is to run back to mummy for help. So parents, let me ask you, what would you rather? Would you rather teenagers who were sheltered from the hardship of the world, or teenagers who were equipped to face the hardship of the world? So, that's what many of the experts say are the major factors in the lack of resilience in the West. My guess is we'd prefer not to be like that. My guess is we'd prefer not to be knocked down for the count. So how is it that we can grow the resilience we need to face suffering when it comes? Even real tough suffering. I mean, there are people at this church who are going through really serious suffering right now. How can we get through it? Well, for this we turn to our passage today. So if you've got your Bibles open there at James chapter 1, James starts his letter in the usual way, but then straight off the bat, verse 2 of the letter, he says this: "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds." Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds. Now, to understand what James is talking about here, we need to focus on the very first word, consider. Consider it pure joy. Please understand, James is not saying that our primary emotion during times of suffering is to be joy. Right? James knows our primary emotion during suffering should be sadness, grief, maybe even anger. Actually, it needs to be sadness. We see this from Jesus. So Jesus, when he was standing outside of his friend's tomb, Lazarus's tomb, even though in a minute's time he was going to bring Lazarus back from the dead, Jesus was deeply sad. He wept. Right? We need to be sad when tough times come in order to properly process it and work through it. What James is talking about in this passage here is perspective. Right? He says, yes, grieve your suffering, but grieve as someone who has the right perspective. And what is the right perspective? We see this in verse 3. "Because," James says, "you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance." Now, perseverance is another word for resilience. Right? "You know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything." And what James is saying is, when suffering comes, we need to stop and deliberately look at the bigger picture. Right? What he means is, look at the long-term perspective on suffering. Look at the end result of suffering. And the end result is suffering turns us into mature and complete people. The phrase there, not lacking anything, means that no matter what comes our way in life, we will have the strength to deal with it so that it will not knock us down for the count. And suffering does this because suffering is like smelting. If you don't know if you've heard of smelting before, but smelting is how you refine metal. You see, when we dig precious metals out of the ground, just take gold, for example, all right, it doesn't come in the refined gold we're used to. It comes out as an ore, which is full of all sorts of impurities. Now, to get rid of those impurities, you put it into a smelter where it's heated so it melts, and then they put a flux agent in that starts a chemical reaction. And the chemical reaction, along with the heat, separates all those impurities out and makes them float to the surface, which is what's called dross or slag, and that dross is then removed, leaving the refined gold we see in our jewelry today. And James is telling us this is what suffering does to our character. It refines it. It leaves nothing but precious gold behind. Now, older people get this more than younger people. The reason being that they've been put through the furnace of suffering perhaps many times in their life. And so if you want to know, if you're a young person, you want to know the benefits of suffering, talk to someone older, because older people know that suffering makes us a better husband or wife. Older people know that suffering makes us a better father or mother. Older people know that suffering makes us a better employee or employer or just friend, all right? Suffering makes us better at making every decision in life, because suffering gives us not only a better understanding of how the world works, it gives us a better understanding of our limitations as a person. Right? What James is saying here is that suffering helps us do virtually everything we do in life better. The Apostle Paul says the same thing. Romans 8:28, we've heard it several times in recent weeks. Romans 8:28, and we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him. See, what God is saying in his word is, if you trust me in your suffering and you stand firm, I can use your hardship to turn you into gold. And here's the thing, not only will that gold make you stronger in yourself, God says, I can use you to help others through their time of trial. Like, I'm not lying to you when I say that the people I've seen in this church who have been most helpful to others who are suffering are people who have gone through the most suffering themselves. I'll say that again because it's important. Those who have experienced the greatest suffering in life are generally the greatest help to others, because their gold has been the most refined. So, it's all about perspective. It's about knowing that God is using your suffering to make you mature, complete, not lacking anything. So is that all we need? Perspective? Well, sadly, no, it's not. The reason being that if suffering is not handled, if it's handled poorly, then suffering can actually have the opposite effect, right? So instead of making us better, suffering can make us worse. Instead of refining us, suffering can actually just burn us up. Instead of making us more empathetic towards others, right, suffering, if we let it, can actually make us bitter and cynical and more self-absorbed. And the difference between those two things comes down to one thing. Right, the difference between suffering that turns us into gold or suffering that turns us into dross is what we lean on during times of trouble. Jesus concluded the Sermon on the Mount with the parable of the man who built his house upon the rock versus the man who built his house upon the sand. Now, for those who are not familiar with this story, when the torrents of life smashed against those houses, all right, the house upon the rock survived, whereas the house upon the sand was knocked down for the count. And the point of this parable is that the rock is Jesus, whereas the sand is our idols. All right, so an idol, according to the Bible, is anything else in life that we cannot do without. It is that treasure that we must have in life, or life is not worth living. It's the thing that we put our trust in, other than God. And those who build their house upon the sand, these are people who have as their ultimate treasure things like the approval of others, or money, or marriage, or successful kids, or career, or power, or looks, or comfort, or reputation, or sex. Now, here's the thing. What do you think happens to such a person when their idol is threatened? Well, I'll tell you, three things happen. Number one, they start to go a bit crazy. They get a bit desperate. They will do anything to protect their idol. Right? They will do dangerous things. They will do hurtful things to be able to protect their treasure. Second, if they're having trouble protecting their treasure, and they will, then they become deeply embittered and self-absorbed. And they spend their whole time just trying to protect their treasure rather than getting on with life. And that will often turn a lot of people to addiction, to numb the pain of their foundation being so badly rocked. And the third thing that happens is they start to blame God. We actually see this in our passage. Well, sorry, it's the verse after our passage. Have a look at verse 13. So we stopped at verse 12, but verse 13 says, "When tempted, no one should say, 'God is tempting me,' for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone." These people start to look for someone to blame. The best person to blame is God. Now, the way to avoid this, the way to avoid turning against God, the way to avoid turning to addiction, and the way to avoid turning to desperate measures is to build our house upon the one thing that will actually stand firm when the torrents of life smash against us. And that thing is Jesus. The way to stand firm against life's hardships is to build our life upon Jesus, to make Jesus our ultimate treasure. But why would we do this, you might ask? What is it that's so special about Jesus that makes him be able to help us stand firm? Well, the thing about Jesus, the reason that he should be our ultimate treasure in life, the thing we can't do without, is because Jesus stood firm for you. And when we see Jesus standing firm for us, it makes us want to stand firm for Jesus. Now, what do I mean by this? Let me explain using one of the most famous battles in history, the Battle of Thermopylae. Now, if you have, you may have heard of the Battle of Thermopylae. It was made into a movie a couple of years ago called 300, but it was a very famous battle that occurred. It took place in 480 BC, and it occurred when King Xerxes, now that's the King Xerxes from the Old Testament book of Esther, right? King Xerxes tried to conquer the nation of Greece with, get this, 1 million Persian soldiers, we believe. So he showed up to Greece with 1 million Persian soldiers. The Greeks were caught a bit off guard. In order to allow the Greek army to sort of rally together, 300 Spartans stood firm at a narrow coastal pass in Thermopylae. And they actually stopped the Persian advance for almost a week. Now, in the end, all 300 Spartans died. But the heroics of those 300 Spartans inspired the Greek army, who were still outnumbered 3-1. Right, 3-1. But they inspired the Greek army to stand firm. And as history shows, they won. They kicked the Persians back to Persia. The movie 300 actually ends with a very rousing speech where one of the Spartans calls the entire Greek army to remember the 300. Because when we see others standing firm for us, it strengthens us to stand firm as well. Now, how does this relate to Jesus? Well, friends, when Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane, that was the night he was betrayed, we are told that he sweated blood. Now, there's actually a medical term for it. I didn't write it down. But doctors say the thing that would cause someone to sweat blood is either acute fear or extreme emotional stress. Now just picture that for a second. Jesus experienced acute fear and extreme emotional stress that night as he faced down the cross. Now, as our regulars know, the real torture of the cross was not physical. It was emotional and spiritual. It was the emotional and spiritual weight of having to endure the full wrath of God. Now, the reason Jesus sweated blood was because he knew the cross would result in infinite pain. Right? Doctors measure pain from 1 to 10. Jesus was staring down infinite pain. Yet he stood firm. Jesus went to the cross willingly to take the punishment that you and I deserve for our sins. You and I deserve infinite pain for rebelling against the one person we are infinitely obliged to obey. Yet in order to protect us from that, Jesus stepped into our place. Though he faced acute fear and extreme emotional stress, Jesus stood firm for us. And that's why living for Jesus is immensely better than living for career or looks or reputation or sex. Only Jesus can give us the motivation, the strength to stand firm in the face of hardship because he stood firm for us in the face of infinite hardship. The interesting thing to understand about the house upon the rock versus the house upon the sand is that no human actually has their house completely on the rock, right? Every human heart has idols in it. So at least part of our house, if I can call it that, is built upon a very, very unstable foundation. The question we need to ask, though, is when the torrents of life come smashing against us, how are we going to handle them? That's what this whole topic is about. If our perspective focuses only on the suffering and only what it's doing to our beloved idols, then our house is actually just going to tip towards the sand more and start to sink. But if our perspective is on God, and if our suffering, we view our suffering as God refining us, and if we can stand firm in that suffering, knowing that Jesus stood firm for us, what actually happens is we can push our house further over to the rock, and our foundation is more stable. Suffering can push us closer to Jesus. So friends, may we not run from suffering like scared little children. Don't pray for it, but don't run from it. May we not protect our kids from all forms of suffering. May we not blame God for our suffering. Rather, when the torrents of life come smashing against us, may we stop and remember that God is refining us to be even more like his Son, who stood firm for us.